little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Since the topic is the rules of prayer, particularly speaking, we were talking about doubts, especially in the previous episode, especially approaching the end of that episode. We promised our audience, Sheikh Javid, to talk about some of those doubts that should be ignored while offering the prayer. We just started talking about those doubts that should be ignored, such as the topic of the frequent doubter, Kathir al-Shak. Would you continue talking about those doubts, please?
Well, Bismillah ar-Rahman, there are certain and a number of doubts which must be ignored, and these are very helpful for a person. Mm-hmm. If a person knows how to handle his doubts, I think it will be in his benefit.
Yes.
A doubt about an action whose mm-hmm. time of performance has already passed, like for example during ruku, a person yes. doubts as to whether he has done or he has recited Surah Al-Hamd or not, or he has recited Surah Ikhlas or not, because he is doing ruku and mm-hmm. he cannot repeat the ruku.
Yes.
So since the time has passed, he should ignore his doubt mm-hmm. and assume that he has recited the zikr. Even
zikr,
if
yes.
he later understands or realizes that he did not recite hamd and the zikr, of course his prayer still remains valid. Mm-hmm. His prayer remains in order.
When we are talking about doubts, Sheikh Javid, basically we are talking about 50-50 chance, right?
Yes.
If any part, any scale, any end of this scale, in fact, goes over or higher than the other one, like 40-60, then that's not considered as a doubt, right?
Yeah, that's not considered. That's called a strong feeling.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then you have to act according to your feeling, right?
Yeah, you're right.
Okay.
Yes. That's why the religious authorities have expressly stated in their books that we have time to think a little bit. We should not rush. Okay, mm-hmm. When we have yes. doubt, we should think to come to a conclusion. Maybe we will, if we think deeply and more carefully, we will come to a conclusion. And based on that conclusion or that strong feeling, we can act.
Yes, thank you.
Now, as far as the next doubt which must be ignored by us is concerned, of course, doubt which occurs after the salam of prayer. We know that the prayer ends with salam and it starts with niyyah and takbiratul ihram, of course. But after you have said salam, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, then you start doubting whether I have offered 2 rakats or 3 rakats, whether I have, you know, done the prayer or performed the prayer correctly or not. All of these doubts, no matter what the category of the doubt, okay, whether it deals with the rukun of the prayer or whether it deals with the number of the rakats of the prayer, of course, all these doubts, the doubts about all these must be ignored. This is number two. And then number three, doubts after the time of prayer has already passed. Now you have left the prayer.
Yes.
You have left the prayer. And after a few minutes, you start doubting whether you have done, you offered the prayer correctly or not, of course. That doubt must be ignored.
Yes.
Okay. And then we have doubt of a person who doubts too much. Okay?
Yes.
I think we talked about it in the previous episode, and I said that a person who is considered to be kasiru shak, or a person who doubts very often, very often, must ignore his doubt. He should give the benefit of the doubt to himself. Okay? If a person is offering, for example, prayer, and he doubts whether he has offered, let's say, 4 rakats of prayer or 5 rakats of the prayer, he should give the benefit of the doubt to himself.
I see.
And of course, we have a lot of such people who doubt very often, and they, you know, they try to, you know, repeat their prayers, not understanding what it means to ignore one's doubt in the state of, you know, when one is doubting very frequently.
Yes.
So it's very important to understand and to practice this you know, this law, and to ignore one's doubt when one is. And who is a kasiru shak? A kasiru shak.
Yes, let me.
I think this is very important to understand,
exactly,
because many people wonder as to who a kasiru shak is, or who is a person who doubts very, very frequently.
Yes.
A person who doubts 3 times in the same prayer.
Yes.
In the same prayer, is a kasiru shak. And also a person who doubts 3 times in 3 consecutive prayers, prayers, then he is considered to be a kasiru shak.
Okay.
But it has also been said by the religious authorities that one should be in normal situation. Now, if because of anxiety or because of fear, because of certain reasons, if a person doubts 3 times in the same prayer, he is not considered to be a kasiru shak.
Because that would be like doubting randomly, right?
Randomly, yes.
Not a frequent type of doubt or doubter.
Right.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohan Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our dear guest speaker at the studio, talking about the rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Particularly this week, we're talking about the doubts that should be ignored. Would you continue, please?
Well, the doubt by the imam, one who leads a congregational prayer, about the number of the rakats of prayer, when the ma'mum or the follower knows the number of the rakats, okay?
Yes.
Must be ignored by the prayer leader. Now the prayer leader doubts whether I have done 2 rakats or 3 rakats, but the people standing behind him knows the number of the rakats. So they, the people behind him or the ma'mum can just indicate or just communicate to the imam somehow.
Get across, yes.
Yeah. That to tell him that he is that to tell him the exact number of the rakats of the prayer. So this kind of doubt also must be ignored, whether the doubt whether it is the imam who doubts or whether it's the ma'mum who doubts.
Yes.
So the doubt must be ignored. And when it comes to the last doubt which occurs in mustahab prayers or in the doubts which occurs in namaz ihtiyat, okay, in the prayer which is offered as a measure of precaution.
Mm-hmm.
So doubts, generally speaking, in mustahab prayer must be ignored, okay?
Yes.
Because mustahab prayer is mustahab in itself, in and per se it's mustahab. So the doubts are not going to be obligatory. You are not going to pay attention to the doubts.
I see. Okay. How about this kind of doubt, Sheikh Javid, if somebody is offering the prostration part of the prayer, all right?
Yes.
And he or she doubts whether he or she has performed the ruku or not.
Yeah.
What is he or she supposed to do there?
Well, this is just an example of the doubt which occurs after the time of prayer has already passed.
Yes.
You know, we did discuss this, that if a person doubts about an act whose time of performance has passed, he should ignore his doubt. And when someone is doing sujood and he doubts whether he has done the ruku or not, he should simply ignore his doubt. And he cannot reverse, perform the ruku and then do the sujood again, because it will be an addition of a rukun. Because if you add a rukun to the prayer forgetfully or deliberately or intentionally, the prayer becomes void. You cannot add or you cannot omit a rukun to the prayer.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice answers and shedding a light on the questions regarding the prayer. And particularly speaking, in this program, we were talking about the doubts, especially the doubts that should be ignored in this episode of Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to this program. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Egypt's prisons. It's not strange for Israel, nor America, nor some European nations that are colonialist to enlist some of the Palestinian resistance factions on their terrorist organizations' lists. But it is very strange for some Arab countries to join these nations' efforts that are aimed at eliminating the Palestinian resistance by all means.
Thank President Hosni Mubarak for his leadership and his understanding of the situation, and also to thank the President of the United States, George W. Bush, the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, for their endless efforts throughout the last 3 weeks in order to protect the right of Israel for self-defense against terrorist activities, and at the same time to help create the necessary international environment that will bring an end to hostilities while guaranteeing the right of Israel to defend itself against any aggression perpetrated by terrorist organizations from whichever direction.
Olmert's gratitude to Mubarak was not a result of nothing, but it was due to something. It was due to something between them, something that can be uncovered to us by Hossam Washah from Al Buraij refugee camp in central Gaza. This 27-year-old youth was arrested by the Egyptian authorities then transferred to one of the interrogation centers in the town of Al-Arish.
I was arrested along with an elderly man who's still in jail in Egypt. I was taken to Al-Arish and then to Al-Yadhegli in Cairo. I was held by the National Security Forces. I received horrible treatment, interrogation, torture, and humiliation from the Egyptian National Security and Intelligence Services.
Ayman Nofel, 35, entered Egypt in the beginning of 2008 when thousands of Palestinians opened holes in the security fence between Gaza and Egypt, seeking to get urgent necessities lacking due to the shocking siege.
I was arrested on the 27th of January 2008 on my way to Al-Arish. I entered like everyone else. I was looking to buy necessities. It was during the days when the fence between Gaza and Egypt was penetrated. I was arrested inside Al-Arish city. The police pulled me over and found handguns with the other two guys in the same car. So we were transferred to Sector 4. And an hour later, I was handed over to the National Security Agency.
Ramzi Al-Rai, a young man from Rafah, south of Gaza, was injured by an Israeli bullet and a tank shell fragment in 2004. He continued to suffer from the injury until 2010, when the Egyptian authorities allowed him to enter Egypt for treatment.
I got in around March 2010. I was injured during the Al-Aqsa Intifada. I had tank shell shrapnel in my body. I managed to get a permit for medical treatment in Egypt because I'd been advised to get shrapnel fragments removed, and that treatment was safer and better in Egypt. I booked a room at a hotel after arriving. After about 15 minutes, my room was raided. They threw me to the floor, handcuffed me, and began searching me and the room. I told them, "Why are you searching me? I have nothing. I'm here to get treatment." They said it was a security procedure. Then they took me outside and told me they would need me for only 5 minutes.
Mohammed Al-Hashim lives in northern Gaza. After the end of the war on Gaza in 2009, he and some of his friends decided to go perform the Umrah in Mecca through crossing Egyptian territories.
After living under siege for a long time, we really miss traveling abroad. So we registered for Umrah along with hundreds of others. Just like anyone else, we wanted to perform the Umrah in Saudi Arabia. We were a group included several that had injuries from war on Gaza. We went to Syria, where some got treatment and some others went to Iran for same purpose. We spent 11 months abroad awaiting permission to return home, but to no avail. We tried Egypt Air, but they rejected us. So we decided to fly Saudi Air. When we got off the plane in Cairo, they arrested us as soon as they saw our passports. Then they took us to the National Security Center.
The ceremony of this reception in Egypt went as follows.
I did not expect a strip search. After they strip searched me, I put my clothes back on. Then they brought me bread and cheese. I told them I wasn't hungry. The officer left the room. I thought he was going to bring a supervisor, but suddenly I felt a strong stinging sensation all over my body. They were electrocuting me. They used it on my head, back, and side. They said, "We told you, you will eat. Anyone who refused to eat got electrocuted."
As for Hassan Washa, his reception in the interrogation and torture center included insults, beatings, and other torture methods.
The intelligence services handed me to the National Security Agency. I'd already been tortured by the intelligence agents, but they did it to me again at the National Security Agency. For days, I was beaten, tortured, and humiliated.
Nofal was not one of the lucky Qassam fighters' leaders in the treatment he got, despite the fact that the Egyptian security forces were aware that he is a leader in the Palestinian resistance and is wanted by the Israeli occupation.
They used beatings, fists, blindfolding, handcuffing, humiliation, and insults. They would threaten me, saying, "If you don't confess, we will undress you and give you an electric shock." They didn't, but I wish they would, because it would have been easier to tolerate than watching all those young men get electrocuted.
After 3 days, they began serious interrogation with me, which meant being stripped naked, tied to a metal bed, tied at the feet, with the legs separated apart so that, as you can imagine, they would be able to electrocute me anywhere they could, like in the ears, tongue, and privates. They would rub a diesel fuel-soaked cloth on the body, which caused burn marks on the skin when electrocuted. It felt like your skin was on fire. Those torture sessions would last 1 or 2 hours.
The torture of Palestinian resistors behind the wall of Egypt's national security centers condemns Mubarak's former regime and proves it was connected to foreign intelligence services.
The arrest had definitely been ordered by Israel because of all the questions they would ask. What is the structure of resistance? What kind of preparations have they made? How far can their rockets go? What kind of explosives and weapons do they possess? All those questions had something to do with Israel and didn't mean to harm Egypt in any way. The interrogator once told me, "In 2004, you were part of a resistance mission in Israel." I answered, "If I did something to the Jews, then why am I in prison in Egypt? You should thank me." The officer answered, "My son, if we, in national security, could, we would burn Gaza."
It's not natural. You would feel that he is a Jew, like an Israeli interrogating you. Due to his intensive concern about Israel's security, you would feel that he is not a Muslim nor Arab. He does not have even the slightest bit of the Arab race in him. His questions include, did the Jews harm? All this that you see on TV, and he is asking me if the Jews harmed me? Did they personally harm you? I answered him, do they have to enter our house and kill my brother? So he asked again, so did they kill your brother or father, or torture you, or imprison you or your father? I answered him, so it has to come on my head. They occupied and stole my land, and murdered my people, and killed and disfigured us, and you are asking me if they harmed me?
According to Muhammad al-Hashim, torture methods were numerous and had a purpose. He never expected himself to face terror charges in an Arab country because he is a resistor of the Israeli occupation.
We felt that those in national security and Egyptian security forces were looking for something. They always tried to get as much information as they could to serve Israel and America. For 30 years, that regime supported and protected Israel at the expense of humiliating Palestinians. It made them feel lost and worthless. The Americans paid the Egyptians $20 a day to keep in jail anyone who tried to harm Israel. Anyone, an alleged jihadist or a resistance fighter.
It was like the Israeli agents' interrogation style. While I was there, I felt like I was sitting in the interrogation rooms inside the Al-Magdal prison in Israel. They wanted information, and all their questions were focused on the resistance weapons. the structure of the Al-Ghassan brigades, the range of missiles they had, and how Shalit was kidnapped and kept in captivity. Let's say all this was during the first month. After that, I was kept as a hostage to blackmail Hamas.
When torturing Palestinian resistors does not bring any results, they are thrown in Egypt's prisons in an attempt to make them hopeless so that they might give out information that can help the Egyptian security forces aid the Israeli occupation.
For 24 months, I was alone and isolated in Al-Marq prison in the district of Al-Golubiya next to Cairo. As a human being, I was concerned about the information I had and how I could withhold it, especially information about the resistance weapons and the Shalit issue. Speaking about these issues is very difficult. It's better to die a martyr than whisper about these issues. I thought of two scenarios on how to get released. Either Mubarak dies or Shalit is released. We had strong faith in God. The Egyptian revolution succeeded after Mubarak was removed. We hoped that after this toppling, we would be released from prison.
Ayman was detained in the corridors of Egypt's prisons along with 10 members of Al-Ghassam fighters as part of a scheme to blackmail the Hamas movement. As for Mohammed al-Hashim, he was released after a 10-month journey of torture.
The Islamic Jihad leadership received the message saying their prisoners had been released. The situation in Egypt was very dangerous, so they moved us quickly. In July 2010, we were moved from Al-Kanater prison directly to the Rafah border crossing, and from there to the Palestinian side of the border. Thank God.
After a long suffering, Mohammed al-Hashim arrived in Gaza. As for Hassan Washah, he was transferred from Al-Arish prison to Abu Zabal prison in Cairo.
Abu Zabal prison is known around the world. I never thought that one day I'd be held in there. It's a well-guarded prison. I was in my cell 24 hours a day and not allowed to go out. I was placed with criminals convicted of stealing, murder, and selling drugs. Even though you are a political prisoner, they surround you with criminals to humiliate you.
Hassan might spend years, or even his entire life, in one of the worst prisons in Egypt with criminal convicts. As for Ramzi, the Egyptian interrogators are still making him taste the worst types of torture.
Suddenly he said to me, "Look, I will give you something you never saw before. Today I will break you. I pleaded, please have mercy. I will tell you whatever you want to hear. Look, so far I have managed to stand all the torture, including electrocution." At this stage, I told him, just get me a nice piece of paper, and I will write all they wanted to know and sign it. He was surprised and told me to sit down. I started to sit, but I felt something was underneath me. Then someone hit me in the head, and I plunged down. I suddenly felt a burning electrical current run through my body. I was being electrocuted from the inside. It was nothing like the other type of electrocution. I cannot even begin to describe the pain. Honestly, it's inexplicable. The next day he asked me, "Are you mocking me? You say you will talk when things get serious, but then you don't." I said, "I wanted to tell you to please have mercy on me." Once again, he sat me on the electric chair like it wasn't enough to get electrocuted through the rectum wounds. When they transferred me to Abu Zab prison, I felt like a ball of blood with long hair and nails. My fellow brethren were shocked. They cleaned me up. My journey of suffering and ill treatment came to an end.
Ramzi's goal in Egypt was to get treatment for the wounds he had sustained at the hands of the Israeli occupation army. But the interrogation and torture he received in Egypt added to his wounds in ways he never imagined.
We hope that the Egyptian army would take a serious humanitarian look at the circumstances and case of Ramzi Arai, because his health is in a very bad situation, and he has never been proven to be criminal, nor had done anything bad to Egypt.
After the passing of 1 year for Ramzi in Egyptian prisons, and 3.5 years for Ayman and Hassan Washa, the promise of the January 25th revolution began to loom in the horizon, which reignited hope for the tens of millions that awaited for it for too many years. This Arabian revolution came to change an abusive, merciless regime that inflicted on Egyptian and those around them the worst types of torture, a regime that turned Egypt from the beating heart of the Arab and Islamic world to an economically, politically, and socially poor nation.
We heard gunfire in the afternoon of the 29th. They closed up Abu Zab prison. We felt there is something going on. The TV showed there was trouble outside. There was regular gunfire. The prisoners began breaking the doors and heading for freedom. Some were killed or injured. The prisoners' families helped us. And along the way, we didn't encounter one single roadblock.
On Saturday, we heard that Abu Zab prisoners had gotten out. At 8 a.m. Sunday, January 30th, we broke down the doors and got out of prison. We walked near family homes where we met a nice-looking man. We explained to him we were Palestinian resistance fighters who had been imprisoned by the evil Mubarak regime. The man sympathized with us and let us use his phone. He also helped us get a car. We stayed at his house and moved from house to house until we reached Gaza.
Around the beginning of the Egyptian Revolution on January 29th, Hassan arrived in Gaza as the first Palestinian liberated from Egyptian prisons. And 3 days after him, Nofal arrived home to his family. As for the family of Ramzi Arai, they were the last to meet him. Luckily, for them, time passed quickly.
We were waiting for his return, so my sons went to receive him, and they were quite ready to receive their father, but there was no destiny yet. Of course, he was in the prison like all other prisoners. They were surprised of the groups of people raiding the prison, breaking the walls and doors, liberating the prisoners. He was also liberated.
The doors of prison opened and armed men entered. They clashed with the government forces inside. And before we knew it, we were on the streets not knowing where to go until a car took us to the Ismailia area, and from there we headed to Al Arish. As luck would have it, we were captured by the army. We thought it was going to be prison and torture again. They asked us what we were doing there. Then they transferred us by military planes to Al Aqraba prison.
Ramzi did not have to stay in prison for too long, because after the collapse of the Mubarak regime, he was released and returned home to reunite with his family.
I was in jail for exactly 10 days. I had a release order, so I was released. I was very happy to be free. It felt like a dream to be out and on the way home. When I arrived in Palestine, I could not believe my eyes. I knelt down and kissed the ground. Then I met my friends, my family, and my mother. I felt like I had been born again.
He says that I get this tawfiq and chance to start offering this tafsir, and I wanted to conduct a kind of tafsir which is going to be beneficial for the ordinary people and lay people.
He tries to emphasize the ethical points of tafsir. That's why we may say that this tafsir is an akhlaqi exegetic book.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Surely we've wronged ourselves. What will we say in front of it?
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So, as our dear listeners might know, the program The Teacher is about the life and works of the most outstanding Muslim, especially Shiite dignitaries all across the nation of Islam around the world on different fields of studies regarding Islamic studies. And for today's discussion, we want to talk about a Shiite alim and a scholar of the 14th century. According to the solar calendar, he is no one but Muhammad Saghafi Nuri, also known as Mirza Muhammad Saghafi Tehrani. Sheikh Ziyaniya, let's start with you, brother. Give us some information about the biography and the early life of Mirza Muhammad Saghafi Tehrani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ayatollah Mirza Muhammad Saghafi Tehrani was born in 1273 solar calendar in Tehran. And he moved to Qom in 1341 in lunar calendar, and studied for 7 years in Qom. And after that, he moved again to Tehran. And he stayed in Tehran the rest of his life up to his demise. And he was amongst those scholars that dedicated his life to live amongst people and to be Imam of a mosque and to have preaching Islam amongst ordinary people and, you know, among those people who are involved in ordinary, you know, jobs like merchants and some people like this. And it's important to know that Ayatollah Mirza Muhammad Saghafi Tehrani was the student of Mirza Kuchak Savoji and also Sayyid Abu al-Hassan Rafi Ghazvini. And the most important teacher of him is the late Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri Yazdi, the great alim who established Islamic Seminary of Qom.
The founder of Islamic House of Qom, that's right. Okay.
And also Sheikh Muhammad Saghafi Tehrani achieved the permission of ijtihad, that, you know, certification from Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri Yazdi and also Sheikh Muhammad Reza Isfahani.
That's right.
So this is the brief of his background.
Okay, that's right. As you said, he was very much related to the socio-political and religious scene of Iran, both before the Islamic Revolution and after the Islamic Revolution of Iran. And one of his daughters has become the wife of the late Imam Khomeini, the late Khadija Saghafi, you know, the daughter of this outstanding man and the wife of the late Ruhollah Khomeini, mainly known as Imam Khomeini. Okay, Sheikh Mahdavi, let's talk a little bit about the specific fields of study. I mean, the fields of interest of Ayatollah Saghafi Tehrani, what are they?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Regarding Ayatollah Thaqafi Tehrani, we have to say, as my brother mentioned, he benefited from the great scholars like Abdul Karim Ha'iri. And besides him, we can mention the name of Ayatollah Shah Abadi, who is really famous as the teacher of akhlaq or ethics. This is actually the technical term that we have in Hausa, or it's actually something famous among the Muslims to go and follow one specific teacher who is qualified and eligible for educating and giving instruction on akhlaq.
That's right.
So he was benefiting from the presence of Ayatollah Shah Abadi, that everybody, most of the, at least Iranian, know that Ayatollah Shah Abadi also was the teacher of akhlaq for Imam Khomeini as well. Imam Khomeini was, and this is also very interesting that Ayatollah Shah Abadi was giving his lessons on akhlaq all days of the week. So they were participating in his class, and this is also narrated that Ayatollah Thaqafi Tehrani was also taking part in his private class. So in field of study, we can say most of the Hausawi or typical field of studies that students of the seminary will take and get to the high levels, he mastered, like jurisprudence, fiqh, philosophy, kalam, and exegesis or tafsir, tafsir al-Quran.
That's right.
For the last one, we have one of the actually famous tafsir that we have, at least in Iran, is Ravane Javid, which is conducted by him in five volumes.
Okay.
And it's a kind of simplifying what we have in Tafsir al-Safi, which is conducted by Faiz Kashani almost 200 years before him. So he is saying that I actually wanted to dedicate my life to Quran, and I couldn't get chance. But when he is almost 40 years, 43 years old, he says that I get this tawfiq and chance to start offering this tafsir.
Okay.
And I wanted to conduct a kind of tafsir which is going to be beneficial for the ordinary people and lay people. And as my brother said, for the scholar, when he reaches this level, and then he moves back to his hometown, and he stays in the local, among the actually lay people in one of the oldest traditional neighborhood and district in Tehran, which is Pomenar.
That's
most of the, this is actually one
of a famous neighborhood in Tehran.
Yes, which includes many tourism sites as well.
Yes.
So he stayed there till the end of his life. Mm-hmm. It shows how he was really interested in dedicating his life to the very important issue of tabligh and preaching religion among the ordinary people.
That's all right.
This is one of the advantage of him.
One of the most important people and the revivers of the Hausa in the city of Tehran. Most of the people might think that Tehran has no Hausa or a school or seminary one, but you know, Tehran has, you know, schools and different scholars are over there. He was also famous for compiling poetic collections or composing poems, you know, on the Ahlul Bayt, you know, and this made him great. But he is known with his tafsir, which is called Ravan Javid, by Mirza Muhammad Saqafi Tehrani. Give us some details about this tafsir or the exegesis of the Holy Quran by him.
As my dear brother Sheikh Mahdavi mentioned, this tafsir is somehow a simplified version of tafsir marhum Mullah Faiz Kashani.
Tafsir al-Safi.
That is named Tafsir al-Safi.
Yes.
And you know, the method of Tafsir al-Safi is somehow putting ahadith and also, you know, historical events and also some reasonings. He's trying to put these all together to give, you know, the clarification for the verses.
Okay.
So it's not only relying on ahadith, but also relies on other...
You mean historical and social facts?
Yes,
the
trying
background.
To put these facts together.
Okay.
But the mainstream is rivayat in Tafsir Mullah, in Tafsir al-Safi.
Okay.
The mainstream is rivayat. So that's why Marhum Thaqafi Tehrani decided to clarify this tafsir.
That's right.
First of all, because it was amongst the most recent tafasil that he had, you know, was in, you know, his achievement.
Yes.
So was the amongst the newest one.
Yes.
And beside that, he says that because this tafsir was relying on ahadith mm-hmm. and also mentioning other points, that's why I chose this tafsir to simplify and clarify it for ordinary or lay people to get more benefits from the holy book of Quran. And
What is his main approach in this tafsir?
Yes. We may say that there are some good points, or we may say there are some, you know, interesting points regarding this book. That is, first of all, because he wanted to give a book and clarify this book for lay people, for ordinary people, yes. he tries to emphasize the ethical points mm-hmm. of tafsir.
Okay.
That's why we may say that this tafsir is an akhlaqi mm-hmm. exegetic book.
So you mean an exegesis of the ayahs of the Quran, but with an ethical or, especially, educational approach.
Yes.
Okay.
Another important point is that he is trying also to mention some fiqhi or jurisprudential issues. Besides this, he tries, because Tafsir As-Safi, the main tafsir that Marhum Saghafi Tehrani is trying to simplify, is a narrative tafsir somehow.
Yes. Okay.
So Marhum Thaqafi Tehrani is trying to put those ahadith that at first they seem to be in conflict with each other. Mm-hmm. He tries to put these ahadith under the same umbrella.
That's right.
And to show that there is no conflict between this rivayat, in a way that they all are mm-hmm. in the same, you know, stream, and they are giving the same message to the audience.
That's right.
And another important point is that the, text of the book, mm-hmm. the sentences, they are simple, but they are easy understanding, but they are not giving simple issues. They are trying to give, important points, but in a way that is easy for, ordinary people to be understood.
You mean sophisticated concepts, but in simple words?
Yes.
Okay, this is what usually, the most outstanding ulama have tried to do. In the latest centuries, we could find it on the exegesis of the Holy Quran, on Ahkam, on Etaqadat, and on different topics. When the simplified versions is out, usually there are sophisticated concepts and contents, but the language is simple to understand. Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
And the last point that we should mention regarding this tafsir is that this tafsir is not a long one. Mm-hmm. It's in 5 volumes.
Yes.
So we all know that a tafsir in 5 volumes is not a big one, because we have tafsir about 30 volumes, 40 volumes, more or less.
Yes.
So this tafsir is counted amongst those ones that may be used by ordinary people. Mm-hmm. So it's not, going into very, crucial details and to, bring the audience some sort of confusion that what is the last deduction and what is the last point that the author is trying to mention. For example, when you refer to Tafsir Fakhrul Razi, he is giving different type of aqwal or, points. So in a way that the ordinary people, normal people, they may face with confusion that, okay, what is your last point? So that's Tafsir Rawan Jawid is not trying to put the audience in confusion. He's trying to simplify the stuff as it is possible for the author.
Very good. This is what the public needs, simple to understand and easy to understand tafsir of the Quran. Okay, Sheikh Mahtavi, anything about Rawan Jawid tafsir of the Holy Quran?
Okay, I may have some contribution to what my brother just said, as the approach that you asked for. We may add this as well, that he is saying that I was trying to compose or conduct a tafsir on the Quran, but for the reason Quran has revealed for, and that is the guiding the believers.
The book Hidayatul,
Hidayatul Muttaqin. So I was trying to mostly include these points which have kind of relation with the guidance of muttaqin, or the believers. So this is another aspect of the approach that he has taken in his tafsir that I think we have to mention.
That's right.
But another aspect of his life is the poetry, composing poems. We have to say, I think it's not fair to ignore this part of his life, that he was really passionate poet when it would come to the position of Ahlul Bayt. We have a very nice poetry on Imam Ali, which is called Qasideh Ghadiriyye. He is starting like this. Actually, this is in Farsi. But I think our audience can get the notion of this poetry, which says, Ali Vasiy Rasul, Ali is Zawj Batul, ابو الائمه بر مؤمنان یگان امیر علی ولی و علی والی علی مولا علی است ساقی کوثر قسیم و خلد و سعیر. And another poetry that he has composed on Lady Ma'soomah, and he has called the poetry as the second Fatima.
Fatima Sani.
Yes, Fatima Sani. Second Fatima. And this is also nice that I actually recommend our audience to go and look it up and benefit and enjoy this poetry.
That's right. That's all right. Really beautiful poems regarding Imam Ali alayhi salam, Hazrat Ma'soomah, and the other members of the Ahlul Bayt, you know, poetic collections of Mirza Muhammad Saghafi Tehrani. It was very kind of you. Thank you much, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziya for your presence in the program, The Teacher, talking about Mirza Muhammad Saghafi Tehrani, the author of Ravan Javid, Exegesis of the Holy Quran. It was very kind of you. About his demise, it's mentioned that it was Al-Qa'da 22nd, 1405. According to the lunar Hijjah calendar, he passed away in the city of Tehran. Mirza Muhammad Saghafi Tehrani, the author of Ravan Javid, Exegesis of the Holy Quran, also the father of the late Khadija Saghafi, the wife of the late Imam Khomeini. May Allah bless his soul. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us, the program, The Teacher, on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Call of Islam. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, introducing another Shia dignitary. God bless you all. Fi aman Allah.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked as
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned. We as Muslims must help our brothers and sisters in faith to solve their financial problems. This is what our infallible imams taught us. We have many examples from the verses of the Quran and hadiths that emphasize on the concept of generosity and giving charity in the way of Allah. Helping others is a type of spiritual investment that might be answered in this world and certainly in the other world. It is even indicated that some people might not have money to help others. However, they do their best to ask others who have money to help the poor. This action is also encouraged in Islam. Even in a beautiful hadith, we read that if a person does not have money to help others, but tries best to ask others to do so, is like he who is walking between Safa and Marwa in Hajj pilgrimage. These people are called Sa'i, which comes from the word Sa'i, meaning a person who tries. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
Cultural news.
Social news. Scientific news. Artistic news. With the light.